sitting next to him.
All right, well, good morning and welcome. I'm glad to see such a large number of people here today. We're glad that we can offer this opportunity to earn time and a half on President's Day for all of you. I'm sure that's the key interest. I'm Chair Representative Tim Kelly of the Transportation Committee that we're in, and that we are hosting this with the Senate. Chair Dibble and I thought this would be a fantastic time for us to get back together to do an overview on where we ended up, where we are at legislatively on our conference committee, basically. But seeing that the session is certainly going to be a brief one, it's important that we have the opportunity to sit down and do this prior to March 8th. So that was really the impetus for this meeting, and we look forward to our overview and some of the other updates that we're going to see from the federal side. And with that, I'll hand it over to Chair Dibble for a comment.
Great. Thank you, Chairman Kelly. Appreciate this opportunity for us kind of reboot and re-spark the conversation that we're going to take up in earnest come March 8th. So it gives us the opportunity to just kind of remind ourselves where we are in conference committee. Our aspiration had been to actually reconvene the conference committee kind of in an informal basis. As everyone knows, the House File 4 is at the desk and needs to be taken from the desk, and the conference needs to be reappointed, but we thought we might be able to get started on that process. Other people at a grade level slightly higher than ours thought that wasn't a super idea, but we thought maybe at a minimum we could take this opportunity, walk through the side-by-sides, and just kind of remind ourselves where we're at and what our aspirations are, and then get the conversation, a little bit of a running start on the conversation. And then I'm extremely pleased to see that we're going to hear about the reauthorization of the Federal Surface Transportation Act, and a little bit more about what's going on. Everyone, of course, is keenly interested in our opportunities around freight rail and rail safety and that sort of thing. So I appreciate the opportunity. And senators, you know how they are, how we are, kind of come on rolling in when everything beforehand gets taken care of. So hopefully more senators will show up.
So you are saying we're on daily Senate standard time or something like that?
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, certainly welcome, Senate. Thank you to the House members that are here today. And that's a great segue. Thank you, Chair Dibble. And we will start with that side-by-side. And members, what we're really looking for is a real high-level overview of our where we are at. And so, you know, without getting too much into the weeds here and in detailed questions, this is what this is for. So we've asked both staff of the House and Senate to participate, and they will today. And Mr. Andrew Lee is going to start us off.
Mr. Chair and members, if you turn to the sheet in your packet that's labeled Major or Summary of Major Finance House and Senate Provisions on House File 4, it's a one-page sheet, double-sided. And you start on the major tax provision side. This is a very broad level summary of kind of the major finance differences, and I've rounded it up to the nearest million and used just fiscal 17 and the biennial numbers for fiscal 18 and 19 numbers to give a much more broad level summary. There's a lot of detail that this spreadsheet does not capture. And if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them, or my Senate counterparts would be as well. But just for the sake of this hearing, this is kind of a very broad level picture of the House and Senate provisions. And I should note before I start that the bill that was passed at the end of session last year that had the major transportation spending provisions incorporated a lot of what was in both the House and the Senate position on House File 4. And so that was already enacted. So now what this sheet focuses on is the major tax and spending provisions that were essentially left at the table. So both the House and the Senate language would need to be reworked in order to reflect what already passed last year. So just kind of walking through this at a very high level, the House position depends on a dedication of the 6.5% general sales tax that is attributed to auto part sales. and that roughly $230 million a year and then growing in the out years would be dedicated to the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. Whereas the Senate, for its large revenue-raising provision, relies on an increase in the motor vehicle excise tax and essentially creating a gross receipts tax, which is a tax on the price of gasoline rather than the excise tax. However, if the price doesn't increase to the level that would generate a 16.3 cent increase in the gas tax, had it been an excise tax, essentially that's the floor. And that would increase revenue to the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund by about $477 million a year and about $1 billion over the biennium. Then the other major tax provision that's in the Senate position is an increase in the vehicle registration tax. Moving on, there's a few reallocations that occur in both the House and the Senate positions. Both touch on the motor vehicle lease sales tax. It's about halfway down the sheet. In the House position, I should step back. Currently, the motor vehicle lease sales tax is distributed three ways. The first $32 million goes to the general fund, and then anything in excess of that is distributed to Greater Minnesota Transit and five of the seven metropolitan counties. And in the House position, essentially all of the general fund gets distributed 50-50 between the counties and and Greater Minnesota Transit. And you'll notice that the $14 million a year and $28 million a piece of the biennium doesn't quite add up to $32 million, and that's because in both House and Senate provisions there's a correction having to do with the legacy tax that was going against those funds. I should, and again, this is very high level and light detail, so if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. But the Senate also levies or imposes $10 surcharges on vehicle renewals and vehicle transfers. The proceeds of those funds go to cities over 5,000 and cities under 5,000 by about $28 million apiece each year. Moving on to transit items, the House position dedicates, starting in fiscal 18 and 19, 6.5% of the general sales tax on rental vehicles to Metropolitan Transit capital projects, which generates roughly $40 million over biennium, and also requires that the current 0.25% sales tax in the metropolitan area for the county's Transit Improvement Board, that those funds pay for 100% of transitway operating costs, which essentially and then reduces the general fund amount that goes to pay for those from the state share, because currently 50% comes from state sources and that's right now the general fund and for those transitways, and 50% comes from the county's Transit Improvement Board. Whereas the Senate position would increase the sales tax, the seven county, or would impose a 0.75% sales tax on the seven counties and generate about $400 million a year. And I will also note there's a few other items in the Senate position relating to redistributing the motor vehicle sales tax or invest on the Senate side, but not on the House side. And one final note on this page, all of the House tax provisions are contained within the House tax bill. They're not actually in House File 4, but in order for the spending that's called for in the House position of House File 4, those tax provisions would need to be adopted in the Taxes Conference Committee. And then I'm not going to spend too much time on the second page of this sheet. This just shows the major spending provisions on both sides. Broken out between different MnDOT areas and between local roads and the Metropolitan Council. And so with that, I would be happy to take any questions on the major finance provisions.
Mr. Lee, I'm not. Maybe I just missed it, but did you talk about the motor vehicle rental tax for the small cities?
Oh yes. Sorry, Mr. Chair and members. The if you look back on the first page, there's also a in the House position a dedication of the 9.2% tax on rental vehicles. So you saw that there's also a 6.5% tax on rental vehicles. Essentially, that's two taxes that are applied to that, and currently both of them go to the general fund. And so in the House position, that those the 9.2% tax would be dedicated to cities that have a population under 5,000 and are not currently receiving municipal state aid street aid funds.
Any questions from members?
So, Mr. Chair, I just invite our council or fiscal staff to add anything if they feel so moved.
Mr. Chair, I would only add, and I believe it, and Mr. Lee touched on this, but I would just like to emphasize from our point of view, he's doing a bang-up job on the walkthrough, the numbers. I want to point out that, as it says in the header, these figures are from the February or November forecasts. They have not been repriced overall, but we've had a forecast since then, and we're going to have another one in 2 weeks. So take these numbers with a grain of salt, especially when you look at, say, fiscal year 2017, and keeping in mind that, of course, effective dates would have to be updated, and those numbers would change accordingly. So these are just for, I think, discussion of scope, perhaps.
Absolutely. Thank you, Ms. Boyd.
And then just one comment, Mr. Chair, just to remind members that, of course, the dollars on either side that flow into the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund kind of flow out on a formula basis, so we would take only 95% of those dollars and count those towards road and or work towards state highways, county roads, and municipal state aid streets, and then in the proportions of 62%, 29%, and 90%. A lot of people often look at that number and think that's what we're putting into our state highway system, and we have to remember we're only taking 60% of 95% of those dollars.
What? Any other questions or comments from members?
Well, Mr. Chair, I want to thank both chairs for this meeting. It seems very timely. This weekend I attended a township association meeting in Leisure County, and guess what? They were talking about funding for their roads and really made a strong case about the impact of heavier trucks on their roads, and so this package obviously is something they're deeply interested in. And then yesterday I was at a church in Mankato, and there was a little gathering, and they asked some questions about the legislative session. The second question was about, they asked me what I foresaw the funding package for sustainable increase in transportation funding to be, and I said, well, you know, I don't think I can answer that question, but I promised to ask it here, and so I'd invite comments from either chair if you're able or to share anything or any progress on some reconciliation of the differences in the bill.
Mr. Chair, I'd just say, just look at the right-hand column, and that's on both sides, and that's where we'll end up.
Does that answer the question, Representative?
Well, Mr. Chair, no, it doesn't, because I actually I take issue with that. For all summer long, I've been talking about a compromise inherently involves components from the governor's position, the Senate position, and the House position, that whenever you're offered three plans, that compromise is all about drawing upon those three plans to draw the best from them and realizing that there's some things in there that those in the Senate side won't like, though I may not personally like, but just I guess the point I'm trying to make is that the question came up yesterday, and I just thought, I can't answer this question at all.
Sure. Representative Johnson, in all seriousness, that I guess the fact of both the Senate and the House being here would suggest exactly what you're talking about, is we do realize that in the process here, the end result is going to be based on compromise, and it's going to be a transportation package that we look forward to from a long-term perspective, and that is why we're here. From the standpoint of actually making comments on specific proposals at this time, that's not what this was about. This was to get us all talking again, quite frankly, and on the same page so that we realize where we're at so that we can actually do that. So,
And again, I genuinely thank you for that and the commitment to a long-term. What I'm hearing is the commitment to a long-term package, and the long-term commitment is really important in my where I live, and I think all of Minnesota. So I appreciate that a lot. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I just wanted to echo, Mr. Chair, what you just said to the members and to the audience. Chair Kelly and I have spoken fairly frequently throughout the interim, and have stated even in privacy exactly what he just articulated publicly, that we understand that compromise is important, and taking the best from the packages is important, making sure that we're treating all parts of the state reasonably and equitably, and that we're pursuing a bill that's worth doing and not a one-shot, snapshot, short-term proposal. So those are all kind of the shared values that we bring to this conversation, and I think are probably shared by both sides and by both parties. I would turn it back around and simply encourage all the members in the room here who are interested in fulfilling those aspirations to engage with our leadership, because, of course, they're trying to figure out the best path as well and what works best in terms of both the transportation package and also how we close out this biennium in a way that everyone gets things that they've come to the legislature to do on behalf of the state and on behalf of their constituency. So that means there are larger conversations that are occurring outside of the Transportation Conference Committee, outside of the transportation committees, around taxes and education and that sort of thing. So making sure that getting to a really good transportation package that we can all support on a bipartisan basis at the end of the day is a high priority to the membership of the legislature, and engaging our leadership in that is going to be extremely important. So by whatever means you have available to you, your relationships, your constituents who are mobilized, your grass tops, your grassroots that you can energize and activate out of your district, that's going to be very, very important to do as we head into March and then through the session.
Well put.
Yeah.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess there's one thing that somewhat confuses me just a little bit, and recognizing that these numbers are not really firm yet, and there will be a lot of changes. But I'm wondering if you could articulate for me how much of the general fund are we redirecting to subsidize transportation in this particular case? I'd like to know, and I know that it's not a subject of this committee, but I think we're leaving a hole in the general fund that somebody's going to have to refill, or we're going to have to make other changes to accommodate that. And I guess I'm wondering what that number is that is being redirected.
Mr. Lee, would you like to address that, please?
Mr. Chair and Senator Carlson, I assume that you're referring to the House position?
Yes.
Well, Mr. Chair, the Senate position has some general fund redirection as well, so if we can articulate on both. Maybe our folks have a tally of the general fund resources that we direct in this proposal as well.
Mr. Chair, yeah, the general fund target in the Senate position was about $24 million for the 16-17 biennium. I don't know that I would call it redirection so much as it was mostly increases to already existing programs that receive general funds. For instance, there was an increase of $12 million for the biennium for ongoing operations for Greater Minnesota Transit, which already receives general fund operations monies. I'm sorry, I don't have these delineated, but there were some one-time amounts. For instance, there was a one-time amount, I believe, of $10.75 million in 16 for a local road replacement. I'm sorry, one second. There was, I can go through and get them for you, but overall it was just increases to already existing general fund appropriations on the Senate side.
The title transfer, both the two fees that we increase on, mm-hmm. on titles, those are a repurposing or redirection of dollars that would go into vehicle services, or
Mr. Chair, those surcharges were on existing fees, and they were directed into newly created accounts for small and larger cities. So that was for local roads.
Right. That's right. Yes. Those are new dollars that wouldn't.
There were new dollars. Exactly.
In general fund. Okay. Thank you.
And Mr. Lee.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Carlson, on the House side, the largest redirection of general fund revenue of general fund dollars into transportation funds is the dedication of the sales tax attributed to auto parts. But in addition to that, there's also the dedication of the general fund portion of the motor vehicle lease sales tax and the rental taxes. So the total FY17 cost is about $200 million to the general fund. But once you factor in all of the other things that are phased in the out biennium in fiscal 18 and 19, and that's dedicating a lot of components of MnDOT and the Department of Public Safety that are currently funded by the Trunk Highway Fund and would then be shifted to the general fund. So it would incur a cost in the general fund, but essentially free up dollars in the Trunk Highway Fund for state road construction. That cost in the 18-19 biennium would be about $650 million over the biennium, or about $330 million a year. There's one other thing I should note. In House File 4, there's also some one-time spending of surplus attributed to Fiscal 15. Since Fiscal 15 is already closed and we're more than halfway through Fiscal 17, if that spending were to be done, that would be an additional $228 million, and that's one-time spending for county state aid, municipal state aid, streets, and small cities. So altogether, the cost in the Fiscal 16-17 biennium would be about $200 million, roughly, to the general fund.
Senator Carlson, any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the opportunity to revisit the bill from last year and sort of reconsider things we were thinking then. But it sort of strikes me, I don't know how many of us, but I think a lot of us who live in the metro area think that probably last summer there was never a bigger year of road construction around the Twin Cities than last summer. It seemed like, you know, you couldn't get anywhere because roads everywhere were being rebuilt and resurfaced and so on. And I think it would be very helpful to just get a bit of some background on what is the actual dollar outlay, what have we seen last summer, previous year, and so on. You know, we are managing to build a lot of new transportation, you know, accesses with current dollars. So it just, to me, would be very helpful. So leave it at that.
Thank you, Representative Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of my constituents about a week ago, who apparently is following this well, he knows there are two sides. One involves the gas tax, and the other side involves general fund money. So he said, why don't you ask? And I said, well, I'm going to have a meeting pretty quick here, and I will ask. And he said, Chairman Kelly, I will ask them the question for him. How much are you willing to raise the gas tax to balance your request for the use of some general fund money? I think that's a question that has to be answered here by somebody. Maybe if not you, then your whole caucus at a meeting or whatever. But what is that amount? Will you be willing to raise the gas tax 5-10 cents in exchange for the monies from the tax on auto parts? I mean, why don't we get down to the basics here, and that's what this is all about.
Okay, well, I certainly appreciate the question, Representative Earhart, and I guess that's what our process is all about, and as we get into session and as we're able to talk about these things, I'm sure that will be the part of the debate. Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to go back to the question about the base appropriation switch to use general fund. We talked about the dollar amount. Could you just brief us quickly when it says some MnDOT activities and some DPS activities? I believe it has something to do with MnDOT management. Could you just clarify what those areas are?
Mr. Lee.
Mr. Chair and members, or Representative Bernardi, yes, essentially what happened in the House proposal in fiscal 18 and 19 is that components of MnDOT, and that would include multimodal systems, aeronautics, transit, agency management, buildings, and freight, that are currently funded out of a trunk highway appropriation would then switch to be funded out of the general fund.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Chair, follow up?
Representative Bernardi.
I'd like to learn more about this, and I can meet with Commissioner Zelli again. I think that one of the questions that I have is it's kind of folds into this, but in a little bit different way. It's if we get a bigger bill, what is the management level going to go and the employee level going to change because of that more funding that the agency gets? I'm interested in that. And then looking at this, if it's going to be funded in the general fund, is the legislature going to start being, holding accountable, streamlining, making management make decisions based on a pot of money and not their own discretion on how much they need? And I think this is will be an important thing to look into, because some people are concerned about the bloating of the MnDOT management and trying to get more resources on the front line. And so this could be a tool, it could be a detriment. It'd be good to explore how this would affect our transportation system.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the last 24 hours, the House Tax Committee Chair has said all of these bills are going to be tied together, taxes, transportation, and bonding. I confess that as soon as I hear that, my anxiety level goes up. This room is packed with people who understand a desire to have a clear and good debate on transportation and plans that have been laid out. But I think the public hates, and I think members hate, the thought that everything gets held up until the last minute when two men go in a room somewhere and there is a deal that closes out the session. And, for this issue, my strong desire would be that we would sit down at a table sooner rather than later and have some clear definition of how each of those areas is going to proceed, rather than that everything gets kind of tied up and you don't have the control, then it goes somewhere else. And so just that's observation and not a question.
Thank you, Representative. And I will comment on that, as I think Chair Dibble made a very good point in his opening comments, is that this is the time that we all need to, if you're sitting here on the Transportation Committee, that we do need to have those serious conversations and certainly get that input, because a year ago, transportation was the number one priority, and 2 years ago on the campaign trail, we heard transportation was the number one priority across the state. So we took that very seriously, and we feel our job is to do just that, is to create that long-term plan. A year ago, simply asked for time. I didn't think that we could do this in 1 year, so I wasn't surprised that we're sitting here, but I'm very optimistic and enthused that we're all sitting here today, because we have an opportunity to do exactly what you're talking about. And that is my goal, and I won't speak for Chair Dibble, but I believe we're on the same page.
And, Mr. Chair, I think there was a very encouraging commentary in the paper this weekend, and that is that the Minnesota Business Partnership and the Minnesota Chamber entered into the discussion not just on roads and bridges, but on transit as well. I thought that was turning the corner and a very helpful and encouraging sign of broadening the conversation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hadn't read that commentary. I'm glad to hear that. I'd heard rumors that they were going to come out and start supporting transit a little more explicitly, those two major business organizations. So I'm glad to hear that. And I just want to echo and affirm what you're saying, Representative Hausman, that we definitely all, as legislators, particularly legislators on the Transportation Committee, need to be fundamentally engaged with each other and with the two of us and with our leadership. I don't much care where exactly the package appears, if it's embedded in the tax. I just don't care about that sort of thing. I just care that it's the right stuff done well. Transportation isn't extremely complicated, but it's kind of complicated, and there's a lot of moving parts. And we know a lot of stuff, and all the people in this room, all the stakeholders know a lot of stuff, and we need to get all the little pieces right along with the big pieces. And so just cutting kind of the global deals without really tending to the particulars won't work. So again, I go back to the comments I made a few minutes ago. We need to be really, really engaged so that we do spend some time. I'm a big believer that the more legislators know about particulars around transportation, finance, and policy and how those work together, the better off we all are. I'm not one of those chairs who believes in hanging on to a ton of information, you know, for the purpose of controlling the outcome. I don't think that works best. And to that end, last weekend, when the Senate DFL caucus met, it took a long time to just reacquaint all of my colleagues with all of the ins and the outs and the ups and the downs of the particulars about how transportation hangs together across the state. And I'll continue to do that.
Thank you. And Representative Uglem, you had a question or comment, and I think we'll let Representative Hornstein have the last word.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My comment is, and I'm so glad we are having this meeting with the Senate and leadership here, our two chairs, I believe that we have a historic opportunity here in Minnesota at this particular point in time to pass a really good comprehensive transportation bill that's going to really make up for lost time. I think we all know that our roads and bridges are in very bad shape, and all I have to do is look at my emails from my constituents or get on the road at rush hour, and I know that. There's two bridges on Highway 169 in Champlin that are substandard that we cannot run regular semis over right now. And the cost to business and the cost to the economy is huge. And I hope that politics don't get in the way of this historic opportunity. My colleague Clark Johnson here mentioned the fact that we do need to work on a bipartisan manner for this. And it's with the budget forecasts that we have and the opportunities that we have to break new ground with these proposals on this sheet that we have here. There's no sense doing things the same old way. Okay? There's no sense doing that. We don't have to do that. We don't have to wait till the last minute. And I hope that we don't. And looking at different revenue sources, like some of the other states do, I think is a good idea, at least for a certain period of time so we can catch up. So this is a great meeting, and I appreciate the fact that we're looking at this from a 30,000-foot perspective today. But we have much work to get done, and if we do our job right, our constituents are going to be pretty happy looking at the road construction that they're going to have to put up with, knowing that the future is going to be much better. So I just hope that we can do a few things differently here and get the job done quickly and efficiently. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to echo the comments that my colleague, Representative Uglem, made. I do think that our chairs on both sides here are deeply committed to this, have been talking, have been working together. And, I think a compromise could be within reach if we continue to work hard on that. So I have confidence in you, Mr. Chairman, and Chair Dibble, and all of us in terms of being able to support your work and your efforts. And I would just add that, echoing Representative Hausman's comments, that, a very comprehensive, we've been talking about comprehensive, long-term, solution that involves roads, bridges, and transit needs to be on the table, that we can't just put one mode against the other, one part of the state against the other. This, more than any other issue, I think, transportation really does symbolize one Minnesota. We are all dependent on each other. So, with those principles in mind and with two chairs that are really working hard and, have a good relationship, I think we can get good things done this year as long as we keep those principles in mind. So thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Westrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just as we're kind of pontificating a little, in knowing how important infrastructure and transportation is, I think it's worth noting a big change from last year is a surplus that has increased from last year's anticipation or from what we knew. And so I think that is certainly a new direction that we can look at with a compromise. But another thing that I'm not hearing enough about, and nor do I think is embedded in either of these bills enough, and that is reform. I was here 10 years ago when the last gas tax increase went through, and many of the critics in trying to reach a compromise were opposed to it, including myself, because we absolutely resist reforming how the dollars get spent, and this is a great opportunity for us to reach and meet those efficiencies by injecting reform. And so I think we should, as leaders, really be willing to step back, and even if it's a sacred cow for some group, we've got, for example, the aggregate industry, and allowing them some increased weight limits could bring, in some cases, 5% or 10% lower cost of construction, and we continue to push that and kick that can down the road. And there's other efficiencies with environmental reviews and other ways in how we spend the dollars. And so I hope, as this issue is anticipated to be a big issue this session, I hope that really becomes part of a compromise discussion with the business groups that Representative Hausman talked about. Because if we would have done those reforms 10 years ago in 2000, I guess it's 8 years ago when it finally passed, we wouldn't be seeing the crisis of dollars that we hear about, at least right now, because we'd be building more roads than spending as many dollars on the roads, the miles of roads we get now. And so if we can find 10 or 20% more efficiency as a part of a compromise, I think the taxpayers ultimately want us to be asking those tough questions.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Jensen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question has to do with the numbers that you put out for 2018-19, because I think it's important to get a good understanding of what happens when the transportation committees in the House and the Senate get together in that biennium. My understanding is right now in the general fund we have about $150 million that comes out of the general fund, something like that. When we sit down in 20 to figure out 2018 and 19, does that go up the $200 million along with the $330 million, leaving us with like a base when we start that session, $680 million about? Am I understanding that correctly?
Mr. Lee.
Mr. Chair and Senator Jensen, you would be correct. The base increase, if the House position on House File 4 would be, to be enacted, would be about the current base, which is about $150 to $160 million a year, and then add on that about $330 million a year. So the total biennial increase would be close to $800 million.
Okay,
or the increase, but the base amount.
Okay, so that $680 million base would be exposed to both deficit and surplus information during that particular time to be reduced or increased, just like every alongside every other general fund account.
Mr. Chair and Senator Jensen, yeah. The legislature can decide how the general fund is
right.
allocated.
Okay,
so.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Osman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One person that not, or at least one opinion that's not currently in play that I've heard this morning is, and maybe the chairs could feed back to this, or maybe Commissioner Zelli's in the room, but I really hate to do a whole lot of work, come to a good compromise, and have the governor suddenly change his mind. He does have a tendency to change his positions from time to time with a given month. First the gas tax on the table and the gas tax off the table. Do either of the chairs know the positioning of the governor regarding the two proposals on the table? Do we know anything on the thoughts of the governor? Because I'd really sort of hate to see a veto if we've got a good idea.
Thank you, Senator Osmick. I would say, just like we normally should do, is we need to engage the governor's office. We also have had meetings with the governor's office in the interim here with the intention, just as we've said all along here today, that it does need to be a compromise and we all have to work together so that we want to engage them so we are doing exactly what you're asking, so that we know where everyone stands so that we're having the right conversations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the governor and representatives of the executive branch have been and continue to be very, very engaged across the state and will be over the next few months, going around to different places and talking with local officials, inviting both of us to those gatherings to hear from folks and to really highlight the need to make a major investment in transportation. So that, I think that speaks to the commitment and to devoting time. And then also in these conversations that I've had, first of all, I want to put a kind of finer point on the gas tax statements that the governor has made. He didn't take the gas tax off the table. He was articulating a well-held and well-articulated position of the House proposal, which doesn't support gas tax in the package. And he was basically stating what he perceived to be kind of the facts. I don't think he said then, and since then he's made clear that he'll sign a good package, a good proposal that we bring to him. And so I think that's on us, gas tax or no gas tax. We need to have that debate and figure it out. If we're not going to have the gas tax, how do we create a sustained and sustainable source of resources for our roads and bridges going on into the future? That's kind of the basic value and principle that he brings to that debate. And then in terms of just, you know, commitment, leadership, I think I already articulated that. I sense a strong commitment to getting a really good package through on the part of the governor, lieutenant governor, the commissioner, the chair, and others. So I'm optimistic.
Senator Senja.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for our fiscal folks, and looking at the spending side of the sheet, and specifically to the debt service side, and this is not of great big importance, but it's a curiosity thing. I'm looking at the House borrowing $1.3 billion, the Senate borrowing $1 billion. So the House is borrowing more, but their debt service payments less. Can you help me with that?
Mr. Lee.
Mr. Chair and Senator Senjum, the reason that the House debt service is less, at least in the beginning, is because the House authorizes the $1.3 billion in bonds over 10 years,
okay,
whereas the Senate position contemplates authorizing them over 4 years. So essentially more debt is authorized faster, and so the debt service payment is higher sooner.
Thank you very much. That's all.
Okay. Thank you.
And, Mr. Chair, just here, those are trunk highway bonds, in case folks are worried that we're absorbing our capital investment GO bonding bills and affect that.
Okay. I think we're going to move on at this point in time so that we do get through more of our information, and we'll take questions as we go from there. Mr. Lee, are you finished with your portion?
Okay. Mr. Chair, yes.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair and members, Matt Burris with House Research. Mr. Chair, you had also asked for brief highlights on other finance provisions that were part of the conference committee last year. And there's another document that should be in your folder entitled 2015 Transportation Finance Proposals Comparison. And this is a table about three pages that covers much of the material that Mr. Lee has already outlined. It's a little bit less on the numbers and perhaps a little bit more on the concepts. And I'll start off just by noting a couple of things. First, this is a fairly high level and summary and doesn't include every provision that is included in the governor's position as well as the House and Senate positions of House File 4. So there's an attempt to summarize and hit some of the highlights. And then second, I would just note that there's a lot of the same material that is in the other sheet. It kind of presents it in a slightly different way. The first several rows were largely covered already, involving general fund spending. The committee had discussed previously the base appropriation shift, so that some current appropriations would be funded through the general fund instead of through highway user tax distribution fund and trunk highway fund dollars. Some of the tax and major finance provisions had already been covered. We also previously had discussed bonding. Trunk highway bonding proposals are in all three packages. and it's different amounts over differing lengths of time. And there's also some difference as to what the funds are used for. The Corridors of Commerce program is common to all three. The Transportation Economic Development, or TED program, is a proposal in the House for a small amount. And a couple of the proposals also propose putting some funds towards general state road construction. That's the SRC, the general construction dollars from MnDOT. So with that, I will also just note that some of the other differences regarding the packages involve a fair number of finance restructuring details and then some fiscal and finance type provisions. And so there are a lot of pieces that if you look at a single piece, it can be potentially misleading if you don't take into account other parts of the package. Mm-hmm. So just at a kind of very high conceptual level, I might note that there are a lot of parts that work in combination with each other in each package, and kind of adds to some of the intricacies in the overall proposals. Just to touch then on a couple of highlights of other finance fiscal restructuring and provisions, I'll point to page 3 of the document. Again, this is a partial list, and I'll just touch on a couple and can go into greater detail if there are further questions. One of the proposals on the House side involves, or a couple of pieces of proposal involving transit, would reduce the Met Council's appropriations. It would be a forecasted base that would be formula-based, and the net effect would essentially be to drop general fund funding for the Met Council down to zero over a period of years. And that would be filled through a couple of different mechanisms, and one would be that the county's Transit Improvement Board would be required to provide the full operating funding for transitways that it had previously funded or began funding in the future. There's also a forecasted base appropriation for MnDOT that's proposed on the House side. And in effect, this provision would work to utilize unappropriated fund balance dollars and put them towards state road construction and operations and maintenance rather than those dollars showing up as available on the bottom line each year. It would be baked into their budgetary process as what their base appropriation level would be. A couple of finance restructuring components that have already been touched on by Mr. Lee include the motor vehicle sales tax reallocation that would increase Greater Minnesota transit funding. There's also a proposed reallocation of the so-called 5% set aside. So that's the 5% share that comes out of the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. Currently, there's a formula that allocates that to a couple of different sources, including a flexible account that's largely used for turnbacks. And the reallocation would involve increasing local road aid, municipal state aid, street in particular. And then there are a couple of turnback accounts that are created and funded through other mechanisms. I believe a couple of $50 to $55 million appropriations were proposed for trunk highway turnbacks as part of the budget provisions on the Senate side. And then there are a number of finance provisions. I'll just highlight a couple. Again, we can go into more detail if there are questions. On the House side, there is a proposal for expanding a over-vehicle weight special permit to include additional types of commodities. There is also a requirement of both the Met Council and MnDOT, as well as regional rail authorities, in developing transitways and guideways to need to get specific legislative authorization, either through a law enacted or an appropriation for that transitway. So it would create a cutoff at a point in the transitway development process. The House position also includes a requirement of light rail transit operating costs coming from non-state sources. And then both House and Senate have a couple of provisions that are similar but have different approaches. The conference committee last year had discussed some of the alternatives, but nothing was ultimately included in the budget omnibus that was enacted last year. One of those regards agency efficiencies, and the other is the establishment of a pilot program for public-private partnerships. The House and Senate were fairly different. I think it's fair to say on the agency efficiencies proposals, the PPP program was fairly similar, but there were a couple of policy differences as well as some stakeholder concerns. And then on the Senate side, there are a couple of other fiscal provisions that I'll just touch on briefly. One was establishment of a loan program for local units of government to acquire a right-of-way in anticipation of future trunk highway projects. Another one is the creation of a driving privilege license. This would be a license for those who do not cannot provide proof of lawful presence in the United States. There's also an expansion of Met Council's Right-of-Way Acquisition Loan Fund, or RALF, program that would allow for transit capital project right-of-way acquisition. There's a fee authority provision for city parking fees, establishment of a working group on mileage-based user fees or road user charges, and a review process or establishment of a review of MnDOT effectiveness around organizational effectiveness, efficient resource allocation, and some other areas like that. That, Mr. Chair, is a very brief touch on some of the highlights.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. First. Ms. Berezovsky, would you like to add anything to that?
Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Burris covered it very well. I guess a couple things maybe I would add are on the license plate side, the Senate position was to increase the fees for special plates to reflect, I think, the actual cost of the plate, which would take it from $10 to $12.50, and then also to replace plates every 10 years rather than every 7 for some additional saving in that program. And also discussed active transportation programs and created that program with some mandated base spending for these active transportation programs. Otherwise, I think those would be the highlights for now.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Burris.
And then, Mr. Chair, just to add two other quick things. One is that the bonding length for the House proposal was 7 years, just so you're clear on that. And then the other thing is it had been, I think, touched on a little bit, but just to highlight, the Senate proposal as well as the governor's proposal included a railroad assessment for grade crossings at, I believe, $32.5 million a year.
Thank you. Representative Earhart, did you have a question?
I did, Mr. Chairman. There was I don't know which one of these you were going on, but there's a money that is left at the end of the year is now going to be appropriated rather than left there to be appropriated later or something or other. It's already is appropriated eventually for... So now we're going to appropriate it for another purpose, or we're going to spend it ahead of time, or...
Mr. Lee.
Mr. Chair and Representative Earhart, on the House position, it's the forecasted trunk highway base. And so essentially what happens currently is if the trunk highway fund spends less than is appropriated, or if revenues are higher than what the base amount was for the previous biennium, then that essentially sits in a balance and the legislature can appropriate it for trunk highway purposes. What the House position would do is essentially take that remaining funds or increased funds and say this is the base appropriation, which is set in forecast. So rather than the legislature enacting a new appropriation for trunk highway funds, it would be essentially part of the base. The legislature could change that, but it would alter the presentation of the budget.
Well, Mr. Chairman, doesn't that mean that it's only doubling down on what we know is already going to be spent here? I mean, you're going to spend it one way or the other. why are we, is this increasing anything? Does it give us more money to spend or in a particular budget period? Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chair and Representative Earhart, it doesn't increase trunk highway revenue. What it does is it in base sets what is going to be that fund is going to be spent on between state road construction and operations and maintenance. Without that, is in the current way that the budgets are set, the legislature could choose what to spend those trunk highway dollars, and they still could even if this was enacted. But essentially, it says that all of the new or unspent appropriation is assumed to go to operations and maintenance and state road construction, rather than essentially sitting in a balance and being allowed to be spent on, for example, the state patrol or other components of MnDOT that are funded out of the trunk highway fund.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess I'm saying that we are spending that money now, but we're going to use it now to explain why we're going to increase the spending when we already are spending it. That's my point. We don't have any new money here. We're just spending it in a different way. Does that make sense?
Mr. Lee, any comment?
Mr. Chair and Representative Earhart, I guess I can explain how it works. I wouldn't want to delve into how it's perceived.
Excuse me, I didn't hear that, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Lee.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Earhart, I can explain kind of how the proposal would technically work, but I feel that it's the prerogative of legislators and not staff to expound on.
Well, I don't know who expounds on it, Mr. Chairman. I'm just asking if we have any new money here, and we don't. We may be screwing around with the budget period, but we still have, it's the same money whether it gets spent one way or another. We don't have any new money, as far as I know. If I be wrong, please tell me.
Earhart, I believe Mr. Lee has answered the question to the best of his ability, is that he's telling us how it would be directed. He's not getting into the political issue of whether it's new money or it's newly found money. Clearly it's not. He's just suggesting how it will be directed. If it's not used, it will be redirected back to specifically how it will be used. So,
Mr. Chairman, that's a fiscal question, not a political question. Is it new money or not? But you take it as you will. I just think that we ought to explain to people that it's the same money that's been spent now being suggested that we have found new money to spend. And I don't think that's the case. But that's it.
Okay. Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have two tiny subjects. One, a Senate staff just mentioned, which is active transportation. It was something I was interested in. The House didn't take it up last year, but I do see it in the Senate bill, so I was pleased to see that and that it still remains there. The other one is something that I believe is going to be a new issue this year, which is the Safe Routes to School funds. I don't see that anywhere in here unless it's someplace that I'm not seeing and that it wasn't mentioned, but I perhaps it'll be a new bill this year that we'd be interested in taking up and talking about too, because I know there's a great amount of need out there every year. No matter how much we put in that fund, we have far more requests than we do money to allocate out. And you know, as you know, I've done quite a bit of work with the childhood obesity, and Safe Routes to School fits in there very nicely. And so I would just encourage us, if it's not in here, and maybe someone can say whether it is, but I do believe there'll be a request coming this year to either increase that amount or to put it in here if it's not in here. So maybe you can answer the question as to whether it's in here somewhere currently, and then we can deal with the rest of it during session.
Good, thank you.
Mr. Chair and Representative Norton, on the House position, there is not an increase to Safe Routes to School program. I will mention, though, that the base $500,000 general fund appropriation stays. On the Senate side, there is a one-time general fund appropriation of $3 million for grants for Greater Minnesota bike and pedestrian infrastructure. There is also a base increase for Safe Routes to School, in addition to the one-time spending on the Senate position.
Thank you. And sorry, Mr. Chair, I'm just putting in my plug now for the House to either give further consideration to those particular bills if we're going to kind of start from scratch this year, or at least give the Senate side due consideration if it's going to stay in its form and go through conference committee.
So noted. Berzowski.
Mr. Chair, I just also wanted to add, in addition to the Senate position that Mr. Lee spoke about, in the metropolitan area sales tax, there's actually 10% of the sales tax goes for grants for regional bicycle trail and pedestrian infrastructure, safe routes to school infrastructure, and active transportation programs.
Thank you for that clarification.
And
Mr. Chair.
Just for members' reference, if they look at the flip side of the first sheet that we had been walked through the kind of the revenue side, the spending side, towards the bottom, the kind of the last line item, if you will, under local road aid reflects on the Senate side the safe routes to school grants base increase.
Thank you. Right.
Senator Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While it's more of a policy issue, certainly has fiscal implications, I didn't hear it, that one of the many special sessions that the governor almost called was on Real ID. Is there, and there was no discussion, I didn't hear it, regarding where we're going with that. It's not obviously in any of the proposals I'm seeing in front of me today. Is there any idea on what we're going to be doing with that? Because I really hate to leave session. It's only 10 weeks and kick that can down the road. I've got a lot of constituents that are very concerned about that.
Chair Dibble, would you like to comment on that? Or I think you've been.
What is our ID for Real ID? Idea for Real ID. So as we speak, Chair Scott, who's been co-chairing the working group on Real ID with myself, and I are trading draft kind of first bill proposals with the hope that we'll agree to some language that everyone else finds agreeable for an initial bill that we can get through the legislative process, like literally in the first week, that would lift the prohibition that we have in law right now that bars the Department of Public Safety from being able to plan for Real ID implementation, and bring back to us very quickly within a matter of a week or two or three, whatever, however long it takes them, some data and some information that then would inform the language of a second bill, which would then be the bill to authorize implementation of Real ID, ideally by October of this year, so that when Minnesotans come up for their regular four-year standard renewal process of their driver's license or their ID, they can just come and renew and receive a Real ID compliant license already, if they so choose. I think a secondary shared goal, I don't know if it's shared broadly or widely enough to gain the support of the entire legislature, but a number of folks have articulated that they would like maybe a second track, a form of identification that's not Real ID compliant if they don't want to be part of kind of this national identification program for whatever reasons they have. And so, and there are a number of other policy issues and considerations that go along with implementation that frankly inform the initial prohibition statutory language that we passed a number of years ago. So that's the goal. That's the idea. That's the discussion. Definitely our leadership is very motivated. They want to take care of that issue this year, put it to bed, put it to rest. If I am sensing the constituents that I have and what I'm hearing from my colleagues and their constituents, they very, very much want us to settle this matter as well. So that's the plan as I best know it. Of course, everyone needs to see the proposal and vote in the affirmative, so I can't, of course, preordain the outcome, but that's the track that we're on.
So, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So, Senator Dibble, we're actually looking at a dual track here, that would be something independent of this this budget or possible conference committee report. We'd be running Real ID as an independent track, not going into the big ball.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Osby, that's correct. Yeah, it would be handled as a separate matter.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Burris, you mentioned that corridors of commerce is treated differently in the two bills. Could you explain how much would be spent, is proposed to be spent on the corridors of commerce in the House bill per year biennium, and compare that to what's being proposed in the Senate bill?
Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, in the House proposal, Corridors of Commerce would be funded at $125 million per year over 7 years. And I believe that last year it's actually half that amount. And then on the Senate side, Corridors of Commerce would be at $200 million a year for 4 years.
Thank you. Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to bring up somebody who was talking about reform earlier, and I have a question, and then I want to have a follow-up to it. Where it says MnDOT agency efficiencies, are they capturing like a percentage of dollars that is being allocated into the budget somewhere else? I'm just trying to figure out how does that agency efficiency equate into dollar amount.
Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bernardi, on the House side, there is a percentage that's expressed, and I believe, I'm just looking it up, I believe it's 15% of the SRC budget. And the Senate language does not specify a set percentage.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Bernardi, for further clarification, if you go onto the one page double sided sheet and look under the spending side, about a quarter of the way down the page, it says MnDOT State Roads Program Planning and Delivery. And you see on the House position an appropriations decrease to that budget area of $11 million in fiscal 17 and $40 million over the 18-19 biennium. Okay. That is essentially by using appropriation, reducing the amount for the MnDOT state roads area for program planning and delivery and redistributing it to state road construction.
Okay. Interesting. I can't get my head around that, because we want to make sure that we're effective in anything we do regarding efficiencies as well. And I just want to make comment that there's if you listen to the demographer talk about, our state demographer talk about disparities in our state, one of the things that they addressed is transportation as one of the top five barriers, I believe it was, in a person's life in our state that creates disparities and creates barriers. And I think it's important that when we look at this package, we've been talking about roads and bridges and transit and I think pathways and those sorts of things. It's important that we think that this bill is for the people of the state of Minnesota, whether it's a senior who is trying to, that ought not to be driving as long as they want. They want their freedom and independence, and so the AAA says that they're driving like 6 or 8 years longer than they ought to be driving safely. So we want people to have their independence. The 40% of Minnesotans that don't actually drive, it could be our youngest Minnesotans or elder Minnesotans or people that just choose not to have a car, can't afford not to have a car. We need to have their, we need to be thinking of them too. We also need Barb Batiste went around the state of Minnesota. She's with the Economic Office of Economic Status of Women. I'm not sure the exact title, but she went around the state, and the number one issue for economic security for women around the state was transportation. And then we also have people that work on second shift and third shift, and they need to get there. They may not have a car. So our millennials, they don't want to have. Some of them don't want to have a car. They want to live in an area where they can have transit, or they might only want to have one car. So we want to be a place where we attract millennials, and that's actually where businesses are moving to, or where millennials are moving. Because millennials no longer, as I understand, are like finding a job and then moving like my generation did. They're moving to places where they want to live that have the kind of transportation system that supports their lifestyle, and then they find a job. So I think it's really important that as we move forward as a committee, that we're addressing issues that really affect people's lives in Minnesota, and that we're not putting more money into a system that creates those very barriers that we've already identified that are creating disparities in our state. So it doesn't matter if it's in a suburb or greater Minnesota or an urban area. We all have people who need access to transportation, and they need access to economic vitality and prosperity. And I think we can deliver a transportation package that helps uphold that and moves us forward as a state, rather than creating additional barriers, because we're throwing more money at the same system that's created those barriers.
Thank you. Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Norton inspired a question with me, and I wondered if there's an answer in the room regarding the safe routes to school. If you could, someone could grade how we're doing on that program as far as the requests that have been made and how many have been fulfilled. I'd like to grade the state of Minnesota on how well we're doing with that very valuable program.
Thank you, Representative. I'm not exactly sure if we have those numbers earlier, Mr. Burris. We'll have to look into that. Thank you. So, Mr. Chair.
So I just had this briefing a few days ago in my office, and I can't remember. But the short version is, you know what you need to know when you need to know it, and then remind yourself at some point. But the short version is that it's Rachel Callahan. She'll nod her head vigorously. It's less than the requests, and you know, there's requests, and then there's viable requests. But even so, there's always way more, and then there's some subset of that that's an actual really good request. And there's just a whole lot more in requests for safe routes to schools than we've ever provided on an annual basis. So to that end, I just signed a bonding request. I can't remember who's going to carry it, but I signed as a co-author a bond for the GO bonding bill, $6 million. So we would look to the Capital Investments Committee maybe to provide. These are bondable projects for improvements in communities throughout the state. And that would get us in the ballpark.
And just as a follow-up, I believe Representative Howe has the same bill at the $6 million request. Representative Uglin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know who to direct this question to, but the public-private partnership pilot program, I know a few years ago United Healthcare on Highway 169 contributed for that overpass to their facility and things. I see the governor has nothing in there for that, but both the Senate and House positions are similar or the same. How much money is that, and also what type of projects are envisioned for that program?
Mr. Bruce.
Mr. Chair, Representative Uglin, there was not a funding allocation or an appropriation made for the pilot program. It was more an authorization for up to three pilot projects and laying out of a bunch of, you know, a series of requirements and limitations around that. One of the differences between the House and Senate was in the types of projects that could be undertaken. The House had a somewhat more constricted list of the financing mechanisms that could be involved. Both the House and Senate had user fees, construction payments, joint development agreements, negotiated exactions, air rights development, and I could get you more information on some of those, but I don't know that I could summarize them very well. The Senate had toll facilities, a couple of different types, as also within the list of possible project financing mechanisms.
Mr. Chair. You know, it seems to me that this is a good, innovative, new way of getting some things done in an expeditious manner here and everything else. So I hope we can, both chairs can take a little look at that and make sure that that program is viable with our final bill.
Thank you. With that, we're going to wrap this up. Certainly appreciate all the questions from both the Senate side and House side in regards to that. And I think that this was absolutely the intent, and I think we've accomplished that in regards to looking where this conference committee was at. And now we will switch gears, and we're going to have a representative from MnDOT discuss some of the changes that we're looking at in regards to the Federal Transportation FAST Act, the Fixing America's Surface Transportation. And Mr. Gusecki, is that correct pronunciation, sir?
Gieske,
thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, Senators, Representatives. My name is Mark Gieske. I'm the Office Director of the Transportation System Management Office at MnDOT.
Welcome to the committee, and I appreciate you being here, and we look forward to your presentation.
All right, I'm going to give you a brief financial overview of the FAST Act, which is the Federal Surface Transportation Act, and what that means for Minnesota in terms of funding. Before we get to that, I'm going to go through just a couple of quick terms. First of all, FAST stands for Fixing America's Surface Transportation Act. It was signed into law in December 2015. It's the successor to MAP 21, which has been around for about the last 3 years. When we talk about highway funding, there are two terms that we often use, especially federal funding, that is. We talk about apportionment and we talk about obligation. Apportionment, which we also sometimes refer to as authorized, is typically the number that you will hear thrown about when Congress passes a new act, and they tell you how many billions of dollars it is. They are talking about the authorized amount or the apportionment. That is the maximum amount that can be spent under a bill, thus its name comes from that. The authorized amount is then apportioned to the states, and then that's the maximum amount that they can spend. And there we go. Obligation amount is the other amount. Obligation is the amount of funding that we can actually spend in a given year. It is always less than the apportioned amount or the authorized amount that is in the congressional bill when an act is passed. In the past, it has ranged from the high 80% to the low 90%. For fiscal year 16, we are receiving about 93% of the apportioned amount. So that's the little bit of training on financial terms for federal dollars. So now I'd like to call your attention to a couple of charts that are in the presentation, and there's a whole lot of information packed onto this chart. So I'm going to just point out a couple of things. The rest is details for your information. This is a chart of the authorized amounts. So first thing I would have you look at is the row across the top. These are the programs, the core programs, that Congress has divided our money into. Several of them will look familiar. They were around in MAP 21 or even before that. We have the National Highway Performance Program, which is focused on our national highway system. The Surface Transportation Block Grant Program, which is the new name for the old Surface Transportation Program. We still have the Highway Safety Improvement Program and Rail Crossings, also called HSIP. There is the Congestion Mitigation and Air Quality Program, Program for Metropolitan Planning, and then there is a new program called the National Highway Freight Program, which we'll talk a little bit more about later. The one that is no longer there that you may have noticed is missing is the Transportation Alternatives Program. That program still exists. It's been rolled into the Surface Transportation Block Grant Program as a set-aside reserved amount within that program. So it's still there. The dollars have just been merged into that program. The second thing I'd point out then, I'd move over to the right-hand corner side where we have the totals of the apportionment. And you'll see on the top row of that, we have fiscal year 2015, we had $629 million of apportionment. On the next line below, which is the first year of the FAST Act, we're up to $661. So there is a little bit of a bump that came with the FAST Act. And then you look at the years following that, and you'll see that there is a more modest increase, but still an increase every year through the life of the Act. Most of the increase you'll see is in the new National Highway Freight Program. It's about $19 to $25 million over the life of the Act. That accounts for the biggest portion of that amount that's in the increase. So now I'll have you recall that number 722 that's in the bottom right hand corner. We'll switch over to obligation authority. This is the amount of money that we can actually spend of the money that they authorized us to have. And you can see in the bottom right-hand corner here that this is $657 million. So that's the 93% of the apportioned amount. The second thing that I'd point out here again is that there is the little bump again at the beginning from 15 to 16 of about $34 million. The increases that come after that are probably pretty close to just an inflationary increase. And the total again is $657 million, and I will break that down a little further on the next chart. This chart is how that money gets distributed on a very broad broad look. That top line was the column from the last page. That's how much money we would get from the FAST Act for each year, $604 up to $657 million. Some of that money goes to our local transportation partners every year, and we've put in an estimated amount for that for each year going forward, which ranges from $156 to $173 million. And then the balance of that stays with MnDOT, ranging from $448 to $484 million over the life of the bill. Just for reference, there's a number down below that came from the November 2015 forecast for MnDOT on what we were forecasting at that time, and you can see that there is some increase over the amount that was forecasted. The bottom line, again, is just for reference to keep in mind the fact that half or more of that increase went to the new National Highway Freight Program. FAST Act also contains additional revenue, additional funding for transit, and I'm not an authority on the transit programs, but I can show you that these are the programs that are funded through the FAST Act, and I can also point out that there has been a very modest increase in all of those programs as well, increasing from $23.1 million to $23.9 million between fiscal year 15 and 16. So just a few points on what impacts this has had on Minnesota. We get about $70 billion from the general fund to support funding levels through the FAST Act. Overall, that was just a modest increase in funding levels. As we've kind of shown you, it's in the range of $50 or $60 million a year here in Minnesota. There is a new competitive grant program for major highway and multimodal projects, one in the freight area and a Tiger type program. For nationally significant kind of projects. Other contents of the FAST Act, there are some changes to truck weight limits. Milk trucks, logging trucks may have changes on certain segments of Minnesota highways. Again, the new national multimodal freight network, which currently is mainly the interstate system. There are provisions in the FAST Act for us to add small number of miles, really, a couple of hundred miles to that for connectors to between routes and to multimodal kind of freight facilities. Some amount of that money can be spent off of the system and on those intermodal networks to promote the transfer of freight from the highway mode to other modes. And that new National Highway Freight Program, again, it's about $20 million a year for the state of Minnesota. And that's my quick overview of the highway funding.
Thank you, Mr. Giesecke. We do have a couple questions. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Giesecke, for that overall view of it. It's always nice to know that the federal government is sending some of our money back to us, so thank you. Going back to page 5, though, I did see something that piqued my interest in which we talk about rail crossings, which has been very controversial over the last year specifically and before that. And this is lumped together with Highway Safety Improvement Program. Are they separate? Are they together? Do you know what the dollar amount is for rail safety that's coming from the federal government? And
I don't know. Oh, sorry, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I don't know offhand the number. Tim Spencer, who's following me, may be able to speak more to that because he's going to talk about the rail program. But it is a set aside within the Surface Transportation Block program, so it's also in there.
Mr. Chair, if I could ask a question later, yeah, then, sure. That'd be great. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions. One is, if you don't know the answer, that's fine. Or if you don't want to answer, that's fine, too. Because it's getting into the truck weight discussion. The last surface transportation bill authorized a report that the FHWA, I think, finally issued after much delay. The findings were inconclusive. And I think kind of stemming out of that whole federal debate, there was an attempt to move truck weight limits across the board up on the interstate system, and there was an amendment that failed. Is that correct? Do you know any more details?
Actually, I don't know the answer to that, so I'd have to find out and get back to you.
All right. tasked Senator Jensen with that. Just kidding. Then the second, another source of conversation oftentimes, and I'm curious because I was looking at a chart recently, but I don't think it's updated to the FAST Act, and that is, you know, which states are donor and which states are donee in terms of what they contribute to the Highway Trust Fund. That might be a little bit of a muddled conversation now that so much general fund is coming in to prop up the Highway Trust Fund, but generally speaking, is Minnesota a donor or donee state?
Wow, you know, I guess I don't know the answer to that in light of FAST Act either, so I will make sure I find out that answer.
All right, thank you. We just, so you know, the chart that I looked at was we're a donor state. We put more into the Highway Trust Fund than we get back in terms of tax and other sources that go into the Highway Trust Fund.
I would like to remind people we are being televised, but I also know we're out of copies, but so if anybody's watching or listening online, we do have the documents online as well, and if they want to see the details, so any of the documents that are being presented today. So with that, Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that transportation alternatives were incorporated into the surface transportation block grant, so we can't really tell how much and the growth there. What are transportation alternatives? Are they some of the same things that we might see under the mass transit funding, or is that another category?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, the Transportation Alternatives Programs was the successor to the former Transportation Enhancements Program. So there's a variety of things that are eligible, but in Minnesota, those have typically been bicycle and pedestrian kind of improvements.
And do we know, is there growth there, too, relative to the other ones?
I don't think it grew. I think it was at about the same level as it was before. But I will check and get that answer to you.
Thank you.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question. MAP 21 came with performance measures with it, if I am correct, with that MnDOT's trying to implement. Does this FAST Act come with performance measures as well, and do you know what they are if they do?
Mr. Giesecke.
Mr. Chair, yes, the FAST Act perpetuated the measures that were in MAP 21. There weren't new requirements created, but we are actually still waiting for the implementation of the performance measures that were required under MAP 21, so we don't know what they all are yet. Some of them we know, others we're still waiting, but nothing was really changed with the FAST Act and performance measures.
And Mr. Chair, just want to follow up. I think it's important that our whatever bill we move forward also has performance measures that ties our goals of our state to actually the outcomes of our project.
Thank you. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My understanding from reading some background on this is that the question is, how secure are we in that we're going to get the money that they've listed here? Because, as I understand it, there was not much, if any, new tax revenue raised for this, and they were borrowing from here and there and other pots, and so it's just like borrowing from the general fund. Perhaps did come from that. How secure are we in the knowledge that we will get this, and what sources are we expecting that they're going to fill the pot to?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Congress backfilled the gap with general fund money, and I don't know exactly what sorts of funds they used. As far as how confident are we that we get that, though, we are confident that the appropriation amount is available, subject to the obligation authority limits that they put on it. And as I mentioned in the past, those obligation limits have been in the high 80s to the low 90s of percent. And recently, we've had several years in a row of about 93%, so we're feeling somewhat confident that we'll continue at 93%. But there is definitely a risk there.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I think they appropriate every year then, every fiscal year for whatever the next year is coming up.
That's correct, yep.
Thank you.
All right, I think we're ready for Mr. Spencer then. Thank you, Mr. Giesecke. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Spencer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tim Spencer, and I'm with the Office of MnDOT's Office of Freight and Commercial Vehicle Operations. Many of you know Bill Gardner, who's the director of the Office of Freight and Commercial Vehicle Operations. He's unavailable to be with you today. I'm going to talk about the FAST Act rail provisions. For the first time, the FAST Act authorizes passenger rail programs for 5 years to be consistent with the highway safety and transit programs. As Mark mentioned, the bill authorizes funding, but until the new appropriations bill is passed, we won't know exactly what funding levels will be provided. With respect to passenger rail, the National Passenger Rail Network grants are funding for state-supported train services, new and existing. In Minnesota, this would include NLX, the second daily train service to Chicago, and the Twin Cities to Chicago high-speed rail proposal. $5.5 billion was identified. State match has to be determined. The Consolidated Rail Infrastructure and Safety Improvement grants are funding for improvements on passenger and freight rail corridors, for example, positive train control and other technologies, to improve safety, efficiency, and reliability of the existing rail system. $1.1 million was available, and state match is yet to be determined. The third item is the Federal State Partnership to State of Good Repair grants, and these are competitive grants to fund capital projects that reduce the state of good repair backlog with respect to qualified railroad assets. Just under $1 billion is made available, matched 80-20. And finally, restoration and enhancement grants, operating assistance grants to applicants on a competitive basis for the purpose of initiating, restoring, or enhancing intercity rail passenger transportation for a 3-year period only, $100 million nationwide. The match is 80-20 in the first year, 60-40 in the second year, and 40-60 in the third year. Uh, 2015 freight rail safety policy changes. The Act requires FRA to develop grade crossing action plans for the states. These studies will look at block crossings as an example. The Act also requires railroads to release public versions of railroad bridge reports to state and local agencies that include limited general information on bridge condition and inspection. And the third item is the Act makes a number of changes to tank car safety features and requires industry progress reports on meeting tank car standards. Environmental streamlining will speed up the environmental review process for federally funded rail projects. And then finally, public-private partnerships. The Act streamlines the RIF program, or the Railroad Rehabilitation and Improvement Financing Program, by allowing new types of applications and project types to be funded by this federal loan program. This provides new opportunities for public-private partnerships. Positive train control projects would be a priority, or conceivably could be a priority for this program. The Section 130 program is the Highway Grade Crossing Safety Improvement Program, and continues to be funded with an increase of about 2% per year. Minnesota will get approximately $6.3 million per year over the life of the Act. Community safety grants for hazmat response. FRA is instructed to create a community safety grant program to nonprofit organizations for conducting outreach and training related to hazardous materials accident response. The positive train control deadline was extended to 2020, and there's a one-time funding made available of $199 million for commuter railroads. As Mark mentioned earlier, there's additional opportunities for freight funding in the Act. There's a National Significant Freight and Highway Projects Program. That's a competitive grant program providing $500 million nationwide for freight rail projects.
And second, there is a National Highway Freight Program authorizes about $2 million annually to Minnesota in formula funds for freight, rail, or water facilities to facilitate intermodal exchange. I want to talk for a minute about the state rail safety accomplishments. MnDOT recently hired and has trained 4 rail safety inspectors. 2 are track inspectors who enforce federal safety standards. 1 hazardous materials inspector enforces federal hazardous materials transportation safety regulations. And we just recently hired a motive power and equipment inspector, and he enforces safety regulations for rail cars, locomotives, wheels, and brakes. During 2015, MnDOT's rail inspectors issued about 2,200 rail safety defects and 12 more serious rail safety violations. You also, in your package, you also have a handout from the Department of Public Safety. And also the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency is working with the 5 large railroads on their environmental response plans. And finally, I want to take a minute to talk about the governor's rail safety bonding request. There are 3 items. Rail grade separations on improved oil lines, $69 million. And that would fund grade separations at 3 locations, Moorhead, Coon Rapids, and Red Wing. $10 million for rail quiet zones. And also $5 million for grade crossing warning device replacement. And that's all I have.
Thank you, Mr. Spencer. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Spencer, for bringing that report to us. As I asked earlier, the question came about in regards to the combination on what appears to be the incorporation of rail safety in the FAST program into public safety area as well. Do you know how that's separated out and what dollars from the federal government are coming for rail crossing safety here in Minnesota?
Well, Mr. Chair, members, my understanding is that the only federal funding for grade crossing safety in the Act was the $6 million for the Section 130 program. If there's other funding sources, I'm not aware of them.
If I could follow up? So on page 5 of the report that we have here, thank you, Mr. Chair, the Highway Safety Improvement Program and rail crossings has $41.5 million put into it from the federal government. Are you saying that $6 million of that is coming for road rail crossings here?
Mr. Spencer. Mr. Chair, members, I don't have that document in front of me. Let me do some check, and I'll get back to you on that.
Okay, as a follow-up, if you could also then, when you bring that information back, if you could kind of let us know what the State Department is planning on using that funds for and how it will be utilized, I'd greatly appreciate that.
Thank you. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Spencer, I'm referring to page 16 here. And one thing that really jumped out at me, well, first of all, thank you for highlighting the importance of rail safety inspectors. That was part of the bill that we passed in 2014. At that time, we had only 1 rail safety inspector for the state. Now we have 4. But it looks, what concerns me, and if you could elaborate on this, 2,219 rail safety defects and 12 serious rail safety violations. What is the nature of these defects, and what do you define as a serious rail safety violation? Where were those, and what are those exactly?
Mr. Spencer, Mr. Chair, members, the Federal Railroad Administration makes a distinction between not critical safety defects, and the railroads have 30 days to repair. And those would be minor issues such as loose bolts. They could be very minor issues that need to be resolved. And then the more serious safety violations are the type of operations that need to be addressed immediately, and the federal inspector can essentially shut down the operation until it's addressed. There tends to be very few of those. I can get you more information in terms of the distinction between those those two categories, and if we can release that information on location, we could certainly do that.
Well, Mr. Chair, if there are 12 serious safety violations, I think it would be helpful to know specifically what those are, where they are, do they involve routes that include oil, ethanol, and other hazardous materials. How quickly were they fixed? I think that these are very serious issues, and I hope that they can be that we can have some transparency related to that. And Mr. Chair, I have just one other question related to rail safety on this. This relates to the FAST Act, did the FAST Act address issues such as the volatility of the oil? One thing, Senator Dibble and I had sent some comments when the federal rulemaking process was taking place a year and a half ago. And one concern that we had in that process that wasn't addressed, that I was hoping would be addressed in the FAST Act, was really looking at how do we prevent accidents from happening in the first place. There's a lot here about what we do afterwards, but what about the volatility of the Bakken oil itself? Was that addressed in the FAST Act at all?
Mr. Spencer. Mr. Chair, members, I do not believe it was, but let me check and get back to you on that.
Yeah, that's my understanding is also that that it may not have been, and that would be a serious oversight. And then I think the second issue is, again, we were very concerned about these DOT 111 cars. There was a derailment that spilled some vegetable oil, I believe, into the river, Mississippi River near La Crescent, just within the last couple of weeks. That was a DOT 111 car. I think there were some derailments also in recent months in Wisconsin that involved these cars. Was there anything related to accelerating the phase-out? I think there is a phase-out envisioned, but it's 7-10 years, something like that. We know these cars are dangerous. It looks like there's some issues related to tank car safety here, but what about phasing out these DOT 111 cars? Has that been addressed at all in this act?
Mr. Spencer. Mr. Chair, members, I don't know the answer to that. I know that the FRA is working with industry to move forward to get these cars out of service. I'm not sure if that was covered as part of the FAST Act or if that's independent of that legislation.
Well, I would be concerned about that as well, Mr. Chair, and again, it's my sense that they did some of these cosmetic type of reporting and whatnot, but you know what I'm concerned, you know, reports oftentimes just happen and then they're not acted on, and I think we need something more than a report. I think we need a rapid phase out of these dangerous DOT 111 cars. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A request of MnDOT. Mr. Peterson, maybe, that I appreciate that this slide presentation isn't, like, packed full of millions of words and there's a lot of pictures. I absorb information through pictures and not words better. But I do want more words. So Mr. Spencer provided a lot of detail to kind of fill in, color in the lines of the bullet points, but I wasn't taking notes fast enough. So could we request from MnDOT maybe a follow-up, more narrative, 2, 3, 4 pages that gives us more information about all aspects of the FAST Act and how that relates to Minnesota. For example, I didn't catch quickly how exactly the passenger rail competitive grant program works over the 3 years. I want to be sure we don't lose opportunities like that, so I want to be aware as a policymaker those particulars. I do have a question, Mr. Chair, and that's Representative Hornstein took care of my first question. Under slide 14, general safety bullets, little bit more information about what bridge reports and studies means. And the reason I ask, of course, is that there were some articles in the paper last year about the condition of the railroad bridges around the state and some pictures of some that looked pretty bad, particularly in northeast Minneapolis, and some discussion about MnDOT's request to gain access to those bridges and denial of access, and the lack of authority that our federal our MnDOT hired, but federal safety inspectors have. They have lack of authority and lack of access to those bridges. So what does this mean, bridge reports and studies? Who's doing it? How are they gaining access? Who's going to give us that information? On what timeline, et cetera?
Mr. Spence, Mr. Chairman, members, that's a really good question, and we're still trying to figure out precisely what the Act is going to allow or provide the public. And at this point, that's not clear to us, other than the general notion that there will be something released to the public. We're not exactly sure what that format is going to look like.
Thank you. All right. Well, as soon as we know, I'd like to know why.
Senator Benson.
I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question on page 5, the first slide. As well, I was trying to keep track and keep notes, so thank you, Senator Dibble, for mentioning, because I thought I heard that there's some project that received $5.5 billion, high-speed rail. Did I mishear that? I'd like to know what it is, how it would impact the state of Minnesota, and what our obligations would be if this is a new project and for $5.5 billion.
Mr. Spencer.
Mr. Chair, members, what I was referencing was the National Passenger Rail Network grants. State-supported train services, new and existing. Conceivably, it could be NLX, the second daily train to Chicago, and Twin Cities to Chicago high-speed rail. That was $5.5 billion nationwide, not in Minnesota. And I believe that would be competitive. So okay. At this point, specific projects, specific funding has not been identified.
Okay.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mine was on that issue as well, on page 13, on the issue of passenger rail. Here we do now trail our Midwest economic competitors. Since that Midwest Passenger Rail Group was formed, I think there are now actually two lines already running, Chicago to St. Louis and I think Chicago to Detroit. I'm not absolutely sure that those are the I know St. Louis. I think the other is Detroit. I mean, so that's happening other places. Those are our Midwest economic competitors. Where it says Minnesota will compete for funding, I'm assuming that will not happen unless we have state funding in a budget somewhere. That's usually how it goes if we don't upfront some money. And my understanding in having attended one of those passenger rail forums that MnDOT has been holding, that Wisconsin has already put up their money and we have not. So this is one area where we are vastly trailing all of our economic competitors. Would you say that is correct?
Mr. Chair, member, I'm a freight guy. I'm not a passenger guy. Typically, federal funding comes with a local match, so you're correct that a local match would be required. I'm not going to offer an opinion about where Minnesota fits in with other states with respect to the passenger funding.
All right, Representative Koznick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Spencer, just wondering if you had any comments on the use of exempt rail lines that are used for long-term storage. I believe it's kind of outside this particular thing, but if you, on the federal level, there was some legislation being introduced, if you have any comments on that. If not now, that's okay, too.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm aware that railroads occasionally will start cars on low-volume rail lines. There was an article in the paper recently about the rail line between Duluth and Two Harbors where there was the rail authority, I think, was storing cars there, and it was a revenue stream for them. My understanding is that there's very limited, if any, state involvement in that issue. I believe it's a federal issue.
Thank you. Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Spencer, I have a little question here about the hazmat inspection that's going on. I mean, we have made great strides in rail safety in the state of Minnesota in the last few years, and I think the railroads have stepped up a great deal with some of their track projects and things like that. But I see we have one hazardous materials inspector for the entire state. Two questions, actually. One, are there federal inspectors on site in Minnesota also? And two, does the department feel that one inspector for hazmat materials is adequate for the entire state?
Mr. Spencer.
Mr. Chair, members, there are federal inspectors for all of the areas that we've mentioned, track inspection, hazardous material, and MP&E. And there are a couple other areas where the federal government has inspectors. The state response, to a large extent, is to supplement the federal activities. So the question of what is the appropriate number of inspectors in any one of these disciplines, I don't know what the correct answer is. We've had some discussions, at least internally, about whether it would make sense to increase the number of inspectors, and I'm not exactly sure where those discussions are, but we have had discussions about adding to the number of inspectors, state inspectors, within Minnesota.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Mr.
Spencer, I would hope that you would keep us informed about that. After all, we are talking about whether it's oil or anhydrous ammonia or anything else like that, these hazardous materials, and you know, having one more inspector is probably a cheap insurance policy. Thank you.
Yeah. Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Spencer, following up Representative Uglum's question there, it looked like in reviewing some information that MnDOT canceled about $35,000 in funding for the freight rail office. So my question is, did that happen? If so, could you shed a little light on that, as Representative Uglum was saying? I mean, certainly looking like having more safety inspectors or safety officers would be something that we should potentially be pursuing. So just curious as to whether or not that actually happened, if you could shed a little light on why we wouldn't have put more resources allocated for rail safety inspectors.
Mr. Spencer.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm not aware of that $35,000 that was turned back. As far as I know, that was not part of the railroad inspection program. So if that was turned back, it was turned back from some other activity that I'm not aware of.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Sanders.
Mr. Spencer, if you could maybe help me look into that a little bit. I'd appreciate understanding whether or not which fund it came from, why we would be turning down or canceling $35,000 in funding for freight rail office staff. One other question I had was, back in 2014, I know that about $2 million was appropriated to MnDOT for rail safety. I'm curious if MnDOT has spent or allocated that money yet towards that direction, or they're still sitting on that cap.
Mr. Spencer.
Mr. Chair, members, the legislature provided two appropriations to MnDOT for crude by rail safety improvements, $2 million in 2014 and $5 million in 2015. We are in the process of identifying and implementing projects. The most two locations that we're working on is to close a grade crossing in St. Paul Park, and also we're looking at putting in four quadrant gates in Elk River, two locations in Elk River. There's a number of other locations that we're working on
that would be funded under those two appropriations.
Mr. Spencer, just to clarify that, the dollars have not been spent yet?
Correct.
Thank you. Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to both chairmen, thank you for holding that hearing. Quick comment and then a question. The first is when the study came out with respect to the bridge safety, MnDOT's bridge safety, there was a bridge that was in my district. This is actually a commendation. I was talking to Union Pacific, and I think even before the phone call was over, they had a crew out there addressing some of the concerns about that bridge. I don't know, frankly, if it was unsafe or not. I just know that they made some fixes, and I wanted to make sure that they somebody gave them a pat on the back for it. And you may have covered the answer. I was looking for the question online. You might have actually said it while I was looking. Speaking of oil trains, the number, as I understand it, the number of drilling rigs in North Dakota has plummeted by 60%. At least that's what it says, according to the North Dakota Industrial Commission. Is that reflected in the number of oil trains that are traveling through the state of Minnesota? And if you covered this already, I apologize. I was trying to find it online and didn't. But I'm guessing that the number of oil trains has gone down dramatically. If it's anything reflective of $1.39 a gallon for gas that we're seeing at the pumps these days.
Mr. Spencer.
Mr. Chairman, members, I don't have specific numbers for you. My understanding is that there's still a significant amount, even though the drilling rigs have been reduced significantly, there's still a substantial amount of oil that's flowing out of North Dakota. And to a large extent, that is being transported by trains. Notwithstanding that, our understanding is that the number of crude by rail trains coming through Minnesota is down somewhat. I don't have a specific number for you, but I can get that information for you.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. Substantial and somewhat. I understand both of those terms, but they are obviously terms that don't come with actual numbers, so it'd be interesting to see what that actual number is, and I appreciate it.
Thank you. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On slide 15, you mentioned the positive train control deadline extended. I'm wondering, first of all, how much of an extension was that, and then also, is there a rollout that's going to happen, and is this the same for passenger as opposed to freight?
Mr. Spencer.
Mr. Chairman, members, I don't know the answer to that. I believe it was extended, I think it was December of 15, that at least initially the railroads needed to have this implemented by. Now it's been moved out 5 years. Beyond that, I can get you additional information if that would be helpful.
And Senator,
Mr. Chair, one follow-up. Isn't that true that there are some places or some routes or companies that are already using positive train control?
Mr. Spencer.
Mr. Chairman, members, I believe that's correct, but I don't have specific locations for you.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Spencer, thank you for your report today. We appreciate you taking the time to do so.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And Mr. Qualley. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, committee members. Happy President's Holiday to you all. It's nice to see you in this year. My name is Philip Qualley. I am a state legislative director for the Sheet Metal Air Rail and Transit Union Transportation Division, formerly known as UTU, United Transportation Union. We have 1,200 members in the state of Minnesota who are operating the trains, freight and passenger. And I will keep my comments brief. I do not have a handout. I just wanted to comment that on the questions regarding inspections, respectfully, you know, the primary inspector and authority and responsibility for the train is the train conductor ourselves, and have the regulatory authority. We're the only ones by federal regulation that have to have the 100% updated accurate train list in our possession while we're moving that train. So we're doing the best we can to inspect the trains. We were pleased to have hosted a meeting this past Friday in St. Paul with the MnDOT and Federal Railroad Administration inspectors, and I can tell you the hazmat guys are doing the very best they can, as are our train crews. To the FAST Act, I'll just comment briefly. Number one, a very positive aspect, in the FAST Act was the requirement for implementation of electronic train brakes. The phase-in date is 2018 to 2022, and electronic brakes can stop a train 40% faster. And having operated freight trains and talking to coal train operators, this is a significant improvement for rail safety that we look forward to moving forward with. We, instead of having the brakes set up sequentially throughout the chain reaction of the train, all train brakes are set instantly, and we also get electronic reading on the heat of the car, so on and so forth. Mr. Chairman, I'll move quickly. I know time is constrained. Regarding PTC, it is essentially in the Northeast Corridor, positive train control. However, we do have concerns that already, after Federal Railroad Administrator Feinberg has said there will be no extensions, we see some of the East Coast railroads saying that they will not meet the positive train control deadline as put into press releases prior. Another piece that we're a little concerned about with the Amtrak service nationwide is that the funding sources of the two pools for the Northeast Corridor, a separate account, and the National Over-the-Road National Train Network, which includes Minnesota's Amtrak Trains 7 and 8, those funds have been separated. So we are concerned long-term what that could mean for the long-distance routes, but I do want to say that, just mention that Amtrak does recover 93% of our operations costs from our fare boxes, and we put that up against any airline or freeway system or other mode of transportation. So something to just simply keep an eye on. Unfortunately, there's nothing in the FAST Act regarding crew fatigue mitigation. Our train crews operate around the clock, and I want to compliment BNSF. We are trying to work with them to give our train crews better ideas and windows of when we're going to work so that we can plan our rest and we do not deal with sleep deficits and fatigue issues. The FAST Act does include inward-facing cameras to watch the train crews constantly. Unfortunately, we find that to be reactive technology and not preventative. And with the exception of passenger crews, there's really no protections for employees against summary and draconian discipline, which we would support if warranted. However, nonetheless, just a few provisions that are in the FAST Act. The last piece about the FAST Act that's a bit of a concern is there's no provision mandating two-person crews. And, you know, that's there has been a notice of proposed rulemaking put out approximately a year ago from the Federal Railroad Administration regarding this issue. However, there is nothing anticipated to be released soon to protect the citizens. With that, Mr. Chairman, I would be remiss if I did not respectfully thank the Senate for passing Senate File 918 last year, minimum train crew requirements. And is also contained in the House 1647 omnibus bill. I would respectfully ask the House to hear House File 1166, the companion bill. Again, it simply calls for two individuals on all trains. It is essential that we properly staff our trains so that we can open road crossings. We're not blocking crossings. It's essential that we be able to perform our mechanical inspections. It requires two persons to secure trains as well. And then finally, I cannot overstate the importance of Samaritan response when we have public grade crossings accidents with the public that we can respond to public. I will mention, thank you, Mr. Chairman, that we did an independent poll last year, and it was 665 Minnesotans weighted heavily to the 1st and 7th Congressional District, rural areas. And Minnesotans, after hearing both sides of the arguments on the train crew, two-person crew legislation, carrier and railroad workers, 83% of Minnesotans believe there should be a minimum of two persons on all trains. So, again, I want to thank you for hearing us. We do support the governor's rail safety agenda, and thank you for hearing us today.
Thank you, Mr. Qualley. I will have testimony from the BNSF, Mr. Sweeney, and Mr. Appitz.
switch over here with MnDOT.
Members, as they're setting up, I'd just like both the Senate and the House to know that we are providing lunch for you today and staff up in 300 South immediately following this meeting if you would like to join us for pizza. So thank you for being here again. Mr. Appens.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it's actually working, so I appreciate your patience. And I'll put these right up here. My name is John Appitz. I'm with the law firm of Messerly & Kramer, and I represent the Minnesota Regional Railroads Association here in Minnesota. And with me today is
Brian Sweeney with BNSF Railway Government Affairs in St. Paul.
And we want to give you a little overview of the rail safety efforts that have gone on in the state of Minnesota over the last couple of years. It's rather timely. You just heard some information about this, and we appreciate that you would give us that opportunity. We were asked by committee staff to update you on this, and they're doing so. I just want to make one reference as we start out. This goes back a couple of years. About, I think it was the end of 2013, we were poised to have a conversation about railroads in a different fashion, a fashion that involved railroad economic development. And that particular study that was commissioned by the legislature and prepared by MnDOT and the Department of Economic Development was going to look at how we could use railroads as an economic development tool throughout the state of Minnesota, creating jobs, business, economic prosperity. And there are many examples that come out of short lines, particularly in Winthrop. You can go down and take a look at that, and I don't need to tell that story right now. But I do need to mention the fact that the author of that legislation happens to be in the room right now, former Representative Mike Beard, who's sitting over there. He represents the railroads in southern Minnesota along that line, and he understands what economic development along railroads is all about. Unfortunately, we got sidetracked, if you will. That's a term that comes out of our particular industry, and that sidetrack was a result of a series of rather unfortunate events that took place in our industry and turned both media and public attention toward the question of rail safety. The Minnesota legislature, just so you bring you up to date, some of you were here, some of you weren't, responded with at least three pieces of legislation that engaged the state in reviewing the types of activity that railroads do, reviewing the safety initiatives that railroads take, and also engaged the railroads in paying for some of that particular activity. The three initiatives, just real quickly, that were passed in 2014 under Representative Hornstein's aegis and Senator Dibble's aegis involved, first of all, adding rail inspectors to MnDOT's complement. You just heard about those from Mr. Spencer. Those rail inspectors are paid for by the railroad. We make a contribution every year. The railroads pay for those inspectors. And we'll continue to do so under that legislation going forward. There was also a study that was mandated by that legislation, which required a review of grade crossing safety or grade crossings along all the crude oil routes in the state of Minnesota. That grade crossing safety study requires that the actually, it says that there's about 75 crossings that need some form of updating or another. You heard about some of those some of those improvements being requested by the governor in the bonding bill that was coming forward, is coming forward this year. There was also a study mandated by the Department of Public Safety on preparedness for preparedness for oil transport incidences along crude by rail routes. That study was prepared by DPS. And essentially, it said a number of things. Number one, and I don't think this is a mischaracterization, you do have a sheet in your materials on this particular issue from the Department of Public Safety. It basically said that there is a good deal of coordination that goes on to train first responders, and those are the firemen, the policemen, emergency medical technicians, along the routes where railroads run. Understand that there is a lot of safety efforts made and put in place along those routes, But railroads depend on the communities in which they operate and work in with the communities in which they operate to respond if there are instances that arise. The railroads and pipelines were required to pay $2.5 million for each of 3 years to fund a preparedness, training, and equipment fund that was put in place, and there is some reference to that in the materials that you've got from DPS as well. But that's ongoing. Railroads are contributing to that, and we'll contribute to that over a three-year period. Finally, there was a study of, not a study, but a review that was required in the legislation by the Department of, or excuse me, by the Pollution Control Agency of railroad hazmat plans to determine whether those plans were adequate for response according to MPCA. Those materials were turned in last summer. Some of you may have heard a little squawk about this over the radios. There was some information that we contend it shouldn't be released to the public that got released. Regardless of that, those studies were turned over, or those hazmat plans were turned over, and we had a meeting with some of the folks from PCA, I think it was about a month ago, asked them directly, were the response plans adequate? And they indicated that they believed so. If there's some indication to the contrary, I certainly would like somebody to challenge me on that, but we asked specifically, were those plans prepared and ready to go, and we thought so. They thought so. What DPS is doing right now, and this is valuable, is sort of itemizing, inventorying all the response equipment that's available to respond to any sort of incident that arises, and that's the next step in this particular report that's coming forward. So, let's give you a little bit of an update on what's going on, if I might. And I see we've got about 10 minutes, so we're going to try to get it done in that period of time. I understand what's between me and pizza right now. So, to be safe, you have to make an investment in the industry that you operate. And I'd like to go over three items quickly where railroads are making an investment that improves the safety along our lines. Understand, safety is bottom line important for railroads. Any of you that were at our rail safety 101 sessions this summer, and we invited a number of legislatures and public officials to come and join us, found that we started every meeting that we have with a safety briefing. We don't just talk about safety; we practice safety. So these sorts of investments enhance safety. The infrastructure investments, technology, investments in technology, and investments in training and preparation, both for first responders and for the employees of the railroad. Let me go to infrastructure real quickly first. This isn't a capital-intensive business. Railroads invest about 20% of their revenues in 18 to 20% of their revenues every year in improvements to their track, to their switches, to their signals, to their beds, to their locomotives, to their equipment, and that's more than most industries do. You have to do it because it's some very heavy stuff, and it's very it has to be maintained on an ongoing basis. Understand, however, that that's money that comes out of the revenues that the railroads generate. It's not taxpayer dollars. Mostly, railroads are private companies, and as private companies, they pay for the infrastructure and the operations that they put forward. There have been record investments that have been going forward. Last year, the investment was about $25 billion nationally. In the years before that, it's been about $25 billion. Before that, a couple of years, it's been about $25, $26 billion. I'll show you a quick chart on that in just a second. But since the railroads were deregulated in 1980, there's been about $500 billion invested in improving the operations. Part of the reason is for safety. The other part of the reason for that is because of the demand. You remember, most of you will remember, in the winter of 2013, there was a great deal of problem shipping stuff in this state and the states all across the Midwest and all across the country. There was locomotives that weren't working, there was inadequate cars to be available, etc. There's been a great deal of response to that. And I think it's an interesting statistic to know that about 56 tons of freight, for each one of us sitting here in this room, are moved every year by the railroads. The anticipation is that that will increase by another third over the next 15 years. So you're concerned about highways. The railroads are concerned about the tracks that they operate on because there's going to be an increase in demand. That increase and that application of funds to the infrastructure has also reduced the number of train accidents. This is a chart that kind of represents that. You can see how this flows forward. This comes from the American Association of Railroads. This is the nationwide statistics. And as you can see, there's about a $29 billion investment this past year in the railroads in the state of in the nation. In Minnesota, this is what happened. We said there was going to be about a half a billion plus investment in the infrastructure in Minnesota. And that's what the in 2015, and these are the numbers that have come forward from the railroads investing in their track, in their ballast, in their ties, in their engines, in other sorts of infrastructure that makes the railroads run. The gentleman to my left obviously had the greatest investment, but the other class ones had similar sorts of investments as well. Smaller railroads, the short line railroads that operate here in the state, didn't have as sizable investments. Understand they don't have quite as much resource to make those sorts of investments. And that's another whole conversation that hopefully we can have down the road as well. The other thing we invested in is technology. Before I go any farther, I just want to let you remind you that you have this information in your packet. You can refer to it for a lot of the comments that I make and some background information on what's going on in the industry. This is the first report, or this year's report, the first provision of it by the American Association of Railroads on the state of the industry. Mr. Sweeney will reference this as well, but on page... page 20 and 22, 21 and 22 are the specifics with regard to implementation of PTC that Senator Carlson was asking about. How much is there to do, and where are we at this particular point in time? What kind of technology are we talking about? Well, you can see some of it right here. Advanced inspection equipment, using track monitoring, cars, geometry cars, ground-penetrating radar, laser technology, wayside detectors that figure out if you've got a flat wheel. Yes, you get a flat wheel in the railroad industry, and that's not a good thing because it causes problems not only for the car but also for the track that it runs on. When that's detected, if it's out of round, it's pulled out of service, and it's repaired before it's put back into service. Another thing that isn't indicated here, but the railroad industry is becoming one of the leading users of drones to investigate visually the visually the track that those inspectors on the ground would be looking at as well, but visually using drones now to be able to investigate that. You saw earlier from Mr. Spencer that there have been new standards set for tank cars. Railroads don't own the tank cars that they move. Railroads are common carriers. A railroad is required under federal law to move whatever is available, whatever is put on its tracks, to the location. We don't have a choice as to whether or not we'll move it. And where there are tanks involved with crude oil, et cetera, those cars are owned basically by the industry that puts the stuff in those cars and requires us to move those cars. The railroads have been in the forefront of requiring, of asking the Congress to put heavier standards in place for those tank cars, and in the FAST Act that you just heard about, those requirements are put in place. I think the question was asked, and Mr. Sweeney can help me with this again too, I think the question was asked, when would those cars be put out of service or retrofitted?
Right. The question was raised about the old DOT 111 cars being phased out. I believe the FAST Act calls for March of 2018 for the last of those cars in terms of use for oil.
So, and ethanol, there's a little bit longer period of time in which the cars are going to be made available. And, of course, when you want your presentation to work, it doesn't, right? PTC, we just talked about. I want to show you just a quick little squib. It's about 4 minutes on positive train control, PTC, for a lot of folks.
Do we have time?
I don't know. Do we have time, Mr. Chairman? I was just asked. four. We're just going to run a quick video on PPC so people kind of know what's involved in putting it together.
Positive train control, PTC, is the largest, most complex technical effort ever undertaken by the American rail industry. And getting it right is a challenge that the industry, passenger, freight, and suppliers must meet and will meet. Positive train control is advanced technology designed to automatically stop a train before certain incidents caused by human error can occur. Collisions, derailments, and work zone mishaps. Here's how it works. Through GPS, Wi-Fi, and cryptographically protected radio transmissions, computers in locomotives and rail operations centers across the country are linked. Across the national network, critical information is continuously relayed. Speed limits, train movement authorization, switch positions, location of work zones, and other key operational data. The engineer still controls the train, but PTC acts as a safeguard to prevent speed and train movement violations. The system provides an onboard warning if the train moves within the warning zone of a potential violation. Should the engineer not respond before reaching the braking zone, the PTC system is designed to automatically and always stop the train. But to work properly, PTC requires highly complex computer processing and communications technologies to analyze the vast number of factors that affect multiple and interconnected rail operations. And PTC requires major development, testing, certification, and installation of equipment in a very short time frame. Consider these numbers. PTC will require new technology along more than 60,000 miles of freight rail track. 22,000 locomotives will need to include PTC equipment. And this effort will require the majority of the Class 1 Railroad's 166,000 employees to receive specialized training with the new system. Freight railroads expect the price tag to exceed $9 billion by the time there is full interoperability. For PTC to work effectively, it must be interoperable. Passenger, commuter, and freight trains must be able to talk to each other seamlessly across all railroad systems. Any breakdown in interoperability presents unacceptable risks to the safety and efficiency of America's rail network. A reliable nationwide PTC system also requires railroads to have enough radio frequency spectrum to continuously communicate with every PTC-equipped freight and passenger train operating on a PTC-equipped line. In addition to procuring the additional radio spectrum necessary for PTC, the industry is also in the process of developing, purchasing, and installing new digital radios that are capable of processing vast amounts of data required to keep PTC-equipped lines working safely and reliably. Along with the technical challenges is the Federal Railroad Administration's complex certification process required before PTC can be turned on and become fully operational. All aspects of a PTC system, from locomotives to the new wireless communications network to the thousands of signals, switches, and wayside devices, must be certified by the Federal Railroad Administration prior to any use. This certification is mandatory before trains can go into service. America's passenger and freight railroads will install a positive train control system that strengthens an already robust safety system. But getting it right must be the overriding objective. The stakes involved, the safety and the operational integrity of America's nationwide rail system, are too high for anything less.
Gives you a quick overview of what PTC is all about. The final item that I think is helpful to understand is also that there's a great beyond the equipment that's involved here is also the training that goes into preparing first responders to make sure that safety is that they know how to deal with an incident should it arise. I want to go to one last quick video, if I can, with regard to something brand new in the industry called Ask Rail. This was rolled out about a year ago, and Ask Rail is essentially an app that you can put on your phone. You can't put it on your phone, but if you're a first responder, you can put it on your phone, and the Ask Rail app can tell you what's inside a what is inside any particular car that might be involved in an incident. I won't play you the last one, but I'll play you this one, and I think it might be of some interest to see what's available. This is a quick one.
As a first responder, I know that every second counts when arriving on the scene of a rail emergency. And just as important as speed is reliable information.
The new Ask Rail mobile application brings both to the palm of my hand with a direct link to accurate real-time data.
The best source of rail car information is the conductor or the train's consist. If we can't locate either of them first, a simple railcar ID search entered into the app's easy-to-use mobile interface can tell me whether a car is carrying hazardous material and what it is. With this data, we can determine the next steps in our incident response. The Ask Rail app even provides reference resources like the Emergency Response Guidebook that can quickly supply critical response information for the derailed cars. The app also provides fire chiefs the information on all the materials transported on a train, which helps them manage the entire incident site more effectively. Plus, the Ask Rail app gives me instant access to emergency contact information for all Class 1 railroads and Amtrak.
To learn more about this invitation-only application, go to askrail.us.
So, the other piece of this training is training of first responders along the routes that we operate on. What I can say is that in the materials that you've got, there's an indication that over the last couple of years, railroads have been training first responders at the rate of about 4,000 responders here in the state of Minnesota over the last couple of years. There's another video that I'm not going to show you about a place called CERTSI, which is called the Security Emergency Training Center down in Pueblo, Colorado, where the railroads will pay to send first responders to and cover their room, board, and the costs of the and the transportation to and from. It's a program that about 150 Minnesota first responders have been able to take advantage of. All of these are trained in the use of that Ask Rail app, so that all of them have it available. If they simply put it on their telephone like this. So that's a quick update on some of the things that have been going on. It's not stuff that gets heard about a lot. We appreciate, Mr. Chairman, the opportunity to talk about this. The Burlington Northern Santa Fe is the largest railroad operating in the state of Minnesota, and Mr. Sweeney is here just to talk a bit about specifics as to what they've been involved in. I burned up a bunch of his time. I'll apologize to him and you, and I'll just step back for a minute.
Thank you, Mr. Sweeney. Chair, members of the committee. I don't have a video, but
that's good.
Just wanted to quickly go over what's been taking place the last couple of years. In autumn of 2014, these committees held a joint hearing with some other committees to talk about a host of issues with railroads, particularly with service problems. Pointed out at that time that the problem was we didn't have the capacity for the amount of traffic and that the solution was to spend our way out of it. Those problems have been largely resolved because we have, in fact, spent a lot of money over the last couple of years on capacity in Minnesota. We're current in all lines of traffic at this time and have been for quite some time. Last year, BNSF system-wide spent an industry record of $5.8 billion on its capital program, including $326 million in Minnesota. Some of the major capacity projects were 15 miles of double track on the Staples sub. That's the line heading north from the Twin Cities up past St. Cloud, 2.5 miles of double tracking on our Midway sub in Minneapolis and St. Paul, our improved connection with the Canadian Pacific Railroad in Minneapolis. This was a major choke point on our system. A new siding up near the Canadian border, roughly 2 miles long, including a bridge. Replaced several turnouts. That's where one track line transitions onto another. Replaced several hundred thousand cross ties, upgraded signal systems in several locations, and much more. The result is that velocity is up on our system. Traffic is moving much more fluidly than in the past. Grain velocity last year was about 30% or more higher than it had been in 2014. call traffic, which it was also a service issue, is up 20% in velocity. Amtrak was dismal in 2014, 23% on-time performance for the Empire Builder. As the projects in Minnesota and other states came online, that improved steadily through last year. There was a year-end average for 2015 of 65% on time. For January of this year, it's over 90%. So these improvements are paying off in all lines of traffic. Hazmat training, in the last year, BNSF trained 1,050 local responders in local training. We also sent firefighters to advanced school in Pueblo, Colorado. 47 this year were sent by BNSF, the previous year 118. For the emergency responders, BNSF has launched a website, bnsfhazmat.com. This is communicated to all the emergency response departments within several miles of our tracks. This is a website that has all kinds of information, how to get the AskRail app that you just saw the video about. How to? It has online training. It also has a program so that you can schedule on-site training. Gives you information about how to go about sending people to the school in Pueblo. All kinds of other information regarding hazmat contacts within the company. Getting information on materials. Just a ton of information. Let's see. Last year, no rail car in Minnesota released hazmat due to an accident. There were incidents such as venting or leaks, improperly closed valves or something, but as a result of a derailment, rail accident, there were no leaks from rail cars. None since 2013, I believe. Let's see. Grade crossing safety. Grade crossing collisions were down substantially last year. FRA doesn't have the year-end figures out yet, but through November, the reduction was from 56 in 1914 to 35 through November of 2015 last year. So a significant reduction there. Reportable derailments in Minnesota were also down substantially from 45 to 24 through November. On the subject of bridges, as Senator Dibble noted, there was an article or two in, I believe it was July or August of last year, dealing with railroad bridges. BNSF reached out to MnDOT, Hennepin County, City of Minneapolis. We also invited some legislators and city officials from Minneapolis to a meeting that we held in early September. We had our head of bridges come up from our headquarters to meet with people, review railroad bridges, inspections, construction, that type of thing. Frankly, some of the inspectors who were there took exception with the article, with the way that it was put together. They said it was not quite the way that they would have done it. They were not sharing in some of the conclusions in the article, let's say. Their chief concern that they expressed to us was, number one, having a point of contact for who to call if they do have a question or a problem. Number two, how to make sure that they get a call back saying, we looked into it, here's what we found. We provided them with that information at the meeting, but then subsequently to that, BNSF and the other railroads, the other Class 1 railroads, have launched websites. You can access it through the BNSF website, for example, or through the Association of American Railroads website. But you can get to that to a website for each railroad dealing with bridges. Anybody in the public can get on this, register a concern about a bridge, upload pictures, what you're talking about, give the locations on, and then you will get a response back. So this is a tool that really fills the questions that we got from the bridge inspectors themselves. Who do we talk to and how do we know what you did about it? As was mentioned, we're also using drones for bridge inspections as a tool, not to replace people and the visual inspections that they do, but to supplement that job. Let's see, drones, those were the highlights. Oh, a couple of things. One to clarify, the question of volatility of oil that was raised earlier, I believe the legislation calls for, once a study that's already underway is done, it calls within a certain period of time that a report be made on either the need for rules or additional legislation resulting from that. I think it's 6 months after the report comes in. Some federal department is supposed to report that information. The question about the reports, the response plans that we filed with PCA, there was some back and forth going on. There was the meeting that we had a couple of months ago with various officials, including some from PCA. I asked flat out, you know, has this been resolved? And pretty much it has been. And what we were running into were different interpretations of what things meant, or else looking for, I mean, one of the great examples was we would have in our response plan that we had various contractors, and it was, well, can you provide us with something that demonstrates the, you know, that you do in fact have some sort of a contractual relationship? And so it was a question of, do we give you the contract, do you need something else? So all those things have been worked out. It sounds like it wasn't so much an obstinacy that, no, we're not going to give it to you and we don't have to, as different interpretations about what was being called for that people were able to work out. The positive train control, the biggest problem there is we had the date certain, but mandated to implement technology that did not yet exist. The example I use is, imagine the federal government mandated electric street lighting and Thomas Edison was still working on the light bulb. That's kind of where we were. A PTC system for a light rail passenger system, or even for certain passenger system routes, is much simpler than a freight route. You've got a captive, you know, clearly defined system, standardized route speed, weight of the equipment and everything, so it's much easier to implement there than it is over, what is it, 60,000 miles or whatever of track, where you have any number of variables involving route, speed, grade, weight of the equipment, whether it's loaded or unloaded, all that type of thing. So it's a much more complex system to put in place. We also, frankly, ran into some problems on the regulatory front. After the system was mandated, it took a long time to get a rule about, you know, what it's supposed to look like. And then we had to install a whole host of wayside antennas for the communication program portion of the system. And then for those, we had to go to the FCC, which Federal Communications Commission, I guess, didn't really know what hit them with this huge number of antenna requests coming in from the rail industry all at once, as well as we had to go through the full Department of Interior process with historical site reviews for all these locations and things like that. So it was a very complicated deal. We've spent a ton of money. BNSF plans to be ready well within the extended deadline for PTC, but this has been a very complex, expensive project for the railroads to implement. And with that, open any questions, or else it's pizza time, I guess.
Thank you, Mr. Sweeney and Mr. Appeth. Appreciate that. And members, we do have a couple of questions. I just want to let the committee know we are touring the 3M plant, the Innovation Center over in Maplewood, starting at 1:30. So we do have to be moving along, but with that, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very quickly, Mr. Chair, and I do appreciate that we have limited time and that you've set aside some time for the regular session to have a more thorough discussion. So I appreciate that. Just a couple of quick questions. You know, both with the FAST Act and on the ASK situation with the reporting to first responders, doesn't seem like Class 2 railroads are impacted by this. And, you know, in my district, we have anhydrous, we have ethanol. That's all going through downtown Minneapolis. So I guess, to what extent do we have the non-Class 1 railroads that are, you know, going to be utilizing this or not utilizing it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, all railroads that move hazardous materials, including Class 1s, 2s, and 3s, are required to be PTC compliant, first of all, if that's part of your answer.
No, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Abbott, so I'm talking about that specific app, and then some of the provisions in the FAST Act, my understanding is, don't apply to Class 2 railroads. Some of these rail safety provisions.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, I guess we need to get into specifics as to which particular provisions you're talking about, but they apply generally across the board to any place where hazardous materials are being transported.
Okay, and what about the app that you have the video on?
The app, the ASK Rail app?
I believe that tracks the tank car, so you know where those tank cars are located if something happens on a class. For instance, along the TC&W that might be moving ethanol.
Right.
That car would be tracked on that railroad as well as on Brian's railroad when they come together.
Yeah, we can double-check to make sure that there's coverage from start to end, no matter what railroad it is.
And then, thank you. Then last question, Mr. Chair, is we have some people from La Crescent that are here, and they called attention to this derailment, the CP derailment, a couple weeks ago where there was material spilled into the Mississippi River. And I guess it would be very helpful to me to see, and maybe this is more directed at Mr. Abbott, so it relates to CP, if we could get a sense of, you know, to what extent did CP follow the protocols in our 2014 bill? And I don't know if they did or didn't, but, you know, things like how quickly were first responders called? You know, we had a provision that, you know, within an hour of the bill being of the spill being reported, that they're already advising cleanup. You know, when was the duty officer called? You know, when were the booms deployed? I think we had timelines around that. So I think it would be a very interesting case study to see if, you know, some of those new deadlines that we had would be followed. Because that's concerning, because it was right. We actually had a spill into the river, tank cars, in an area that I understand is where there is some construction, where there's some improvements that are being made. And so for all those reasons, I think this particular incident provides perhaps a guidepost or a case study, and maybe you could report to the committee on that, on those things. So, you know, the law is very clear, so they have to do X, Y, Z in a certain amount of time. Were those protocols followed in that particular incident?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hornsey, we'd be more than happy to do that. I don't think you want the complete answer right now because it'll take a little while, but we'd be happy to respond to you privately and also bring it to the committee's attention as you wish.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Runbeck.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quickly, going back to what the state is doing on railroad safety, I believe in the 2015 bill, and I haven't heard anything about it today, but there was emergency response teams, a plan for that created for St. Cloud and Duluth. And I wonder if anybody in the room has any status update on that.
Mr. Sweeney?
I'm unaware what's happened since then. When it comes to the frequency of spills and so on, a very small percentage of them are rail-related. I know that there was some notion that perhaps the need was increased by the rail industry, but I think it was Minnesota Post a couple of years ago did a review of hazmat spills from using federal information over a period of 10 or 12 years. It was something like 3% of the transportation spills in Minnesota were rail-related. It was like 92 or 93% truck. I think air came in with more than rail did, and then waterway. But the large percentage of hazmat spills are non-rail.
Mr. Chair, maybe I don't know if someone from DPS is here. I believe it's a DPS issue. We got a handout from them with an update, but they don't talk about something that was in the legislation last year, emergency response teams.
Mr. Chair, I think Representative Runbeck is speaking about the additional hazmat team that was going to be, or emergency response team that was supposed to be put in place in St. Cloud, if I'm not mistaken. Right. And I hope the DPS could respond to that for you.
And Mr. Chair, and Duluth, so two cities.
Oh, yeah,
so
right.
I'd like an update on that sometime.
We'll get that. Looks like we do not have a representative here at this time, but thank you, Representative Runbeck. And Representative Hausman, last question of the day.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This might be naive. Is broadband necessary to make positive train control and the AskRail app work?
Not PTC. PTC is implemented through the railroads itself, putting in place.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'll check. I think if you, I assume so long as you have a signal of some sort, but we'll check and see if there are any special cellular requirements.
And then, Mr. Chair, do both railroad workers and first responders get the AskRail app, or is it only for first responders?
It's you know the answer. essentially a first responder application that they can get.
The reason I ask is way back when Willard Munger had the first hearing in Duluth on this whole issue, rail workers were saying, we don't know what's in the cars, and the railroad's response to them was, we don't want you to know because you're not trained to deal with it. And so I wondered if that same philosophy is still there, that you're going to give the Ask Rail app to first responders but not to them.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, the first responders are the only ones who get the Ask Rail app. As has been noted earlier, the conductor on the train has the information about what's in the tank cars with listing of the commodities and so on by car. So they have that information. Then we have railroad people, hazmat people who have access to full information as well.
And then, Mr. Chair, just one final. The 4,000 that you talk about training and on the DPS sheet, they've trained 4,000. Are those the same 4,000? Do you do the training for DPS, or is that two different groups?
Chair, Representative, I believe it's two different groups. These are just the ones trained by the rail industry, DPS.
Mr. Chairman, to Representative Hausman, I believe that there's other sorts of training, not necessarily only related to railroad safety, that the DPS does. The railroad training that goes on is about a four-hour morning course. Our trainers go into the town, sit down with the fire department, and have a four-hour course on this is what a railroad is, this is what it does, kind of like the Railroad 101 course that some of you were able to attend over the past summer and fall.
Thank you, Mr. Appitz and Mr. Sweeney, for being here today. We appreciate that update.
You take
members, we will. We do have lunch provided up in 300 South for everyone, Senate members and staff, and House members and staff. I want to thank our staff, Mr. Berezovsky, Mr. Boyd, Mr. Burris, Mr. Lee, for those updates. We appreciate that. We are going to move the tour to 1:45. So if you are going out to the tour at the Innovation Center, Maplewood, and we will have maps also upstairs. And if you wouldn't mind, I don't know if you've turned in your per diem sheets to Mr. Anderson, we'll get those taken care of as well. And thank you all for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.